participate. They all tried to outdo each other and come up with something more original than the last person had come up with. One of the boys, in calling his turn, said, "Stand up, turn around, do the twist, sit down." He let us twist about 15 minutes before he called the other move. Some of the students did some nasty cuts. Mrs. Evans, taking part in the games too, was so upset that she threatened to have the boy expelled. After that, the boys stopped attending the socials and the girls were very unhappy. Soon, the socials were cut out altogether because didn't enough girls go to them. Now, the only time girls with boyfriends on campus got together was on Sunday from 4 to 6. Then, they sat up in the lounge with the door open and Mrs. Evans sat right across in the next lounge, knitting. The boys weren't too upset over the campus rules because they could go anywhere without permission, spend the night off campus, and do just about anything else except openly tamper with the girls on campus. And most of the boys had no desire to mess with the campus girls because they had 3 or 4 girls in the city. The majority of the girls living in the dorm came from homes with real strict Baptist parents, and a lot of them had been sent on church scholarships. They were some of the most backward girls I had ever seen. They had lived a sheltered life of Baptist fantasy. They were the girls who had courted the nice boys at church, who sneaked kisses in parked cars on the church lawn, who had never spent a night away from home except with relatives who were just as strict as their parents. For them, it was a big thing to be away from home, even in a place as prison-like as Natchez College. Once away from their parents and relatives, they were also the girls most likely to end up pregnant, because at home, sex was a big mystery, tabooed in conversation and bitterly condemned in church. With the exception of Bernice and her 3 or 4 friends, the basketball girls were the healthiest girls on campus. Most of them had boyfriends, loved sports, had a good sense of humor, and didn't care too much about anything. I didn't particularly consider myself in their class. But if it was necessary for me to be in a class at all, I would have chosen theirs. Instead, I was a loner, just as I had been in high school. The only thing I had in common with them was basketball. When the basketball team started traveling, I really saw how hypocritical everyone at the college was, especially Mrs. Evans. Even though we had a lady coach, Mrs. Evans came along to chaperone us. She was as glad to get away from Natchez as we were. As we boarded the bus on campus to leave, she came on the bus in her long, dark morning dress, all plain-faced and motherly. But as soon as we got to the college we were playing, she pulled off that long black dress, put on a short stylish one, and made herself up with powder, rouge, and lipstick. She shocked all of us. She didn't follow us everywhere like she did at Natchez. Neither did she speak in her little proper speech. She was an entirely different lady, and the girls liked her because she let them dance and do anything they wanted to. Just about. But as soon as we got back to Natchez College, she put on her old self again. By the time the school term ended, I was so sick of Natchez that I was sure I wouldn't return the following year. But the schools in New Orleans cost just too much money, so a few weeks before the new term, I decided to go back. Chapter 19. That second year at Natchez, I discovered that I had changed. The year before, almost every boy on campus had tried to make it with me, especially the basketball boys, and I had turned them down one after the other. Now, I found myself wondering whether I should have been so rude to them. When I saw girls and boys sneaking kisses out under the trees, I got curious. Sometimes I wished I had a boyfriend. I was 20 years old and I had never been kissed, not even a smack on the lips. I wanted to know how it felt. There was a new basketball player on campus named Kemp, whom all the girls and boys were talking about. He was tall, 6'5", and slim. Besides being tall, he had a cool about him that most girls liked, so they all went around talking about how handsome he was. It was early October and we hadn't started practicing yet, so I didn't know whether he was a good player or not, but I certainly didn't think his looks were anything special. He looked just like my daddy without a mustache, and I never thought daddy was handsome. I used to see Kemp walking around on campus and wondered what was it that all the girls saw in him. Then, too, he made me wonder what all the women had seen in my daddy when he was young. One Sunday after church, I was leaving chapel when Kemp walked up to me and said, "So, you are Ann Moody, huh?" "Yes. Why?" I asked and kept walking. "I heard a lot about you," he said, walking beside me. "Where are you going now?" "To the dorm," I answered. "If you slow down, I'll walk you over there," he said coolly. For the first time in my life, I slowed down for a boy. I was a little surprised at myself. As we walked together, Kemp didn't try to force the conversation. He hardly said anything, and whenever he did, it was like a brother to a sister. When we got to the dorm, he asked if he could walk me to dinner. I again surprised myself by answering yes. Because Natchez College was so small, most of the relationships between girls and boys were a public thing. Everybody knew everybody else's business. The students were all shocked when I started going with Kemp, especially the sophomore boys who had tried to make it with me the year before. A couple of the guys who had tried hardest came up and bluntly asked me what did I see in Kemp, or what did Kemp have to offer me that they didn't. I was a little surprised at the girls' reaction. Most of them seemed glad that I had finally decided to join the club, so much so that they started giving me all kinds of advice about how to handle men. When Kemp started playing basketball, I really began to like him. He had the longest limbs I had ever seen. As he moved down the basketball court, he was so light he looked like he was flying. He could just walk up to the goal and dunk the ball with ease. Through basketball, he became the most popular boy on campus. Kemp tried to kiss me many times, but I wouldn't let him. I always told him that I had a headache or something. When we traveled to play other teams, all the other boys and their girls on the team kissed around on the bus. Kemp, the best player on the team, sat beside me, begging me to kiss him. Everyone else on the bus knew that Kemp wasn't getting anywhere with me, and most of the boys began to tease him. There were a couple of girls on the team who were having spasms over Kemp. One of them sat in the seat behind us, and late at night she would start clawing on the seat like a big cat. When Kemp started answering her clawing, I went to one of my friends seeking advice on how to kiss. She told me that I didn't have to do anything but part my lips to Kemp, and he would do the rest. For the next 2 months, I thought of how I would part my lips. Then, one night, I dreamt that Kemp and I were kissing around nude on the back seat of the bus, and just as we were about to have intercourse, I woke up screaming. I was so frightened by the dream, I began to think that if I kissed Kemp, it might lead to something else. The mere thought of getting sexually involved caused me all kinds of anxieties. But I had a tremendous guilt about treating Kemp the way I did when another girl would have treated him better. So I made up my mind to quit him and let that clawing girl have him. One night in November, when we were playing Philander Smith College in Little Rock, Arkansas, I decided that this would be the night I would quit Kemp. Since the game was one of our biggest, I decided to wait and tell him after it was over. I knew we would lose if he wasn't at his best. Kemp shot 40-some points during that game. He played better than I had ever seen him play. Just about every time he raised his arms, it was 2 points for us. When the game was over, the rest of the boys hugged him down to the floor, then picked him up and declared him King of Basketball. As I watched him play and then saw how everyone loved him, it suddenly dawned upon me that he was a terrific person and that I was a fool to be thinking about quitting him. When the boys let him go, he walked up to me smiling. Without saying a word, he put his arms around my shoulders and walked me to the bus. As he touched me, a warm current ran through my body. As I sat on the bus beside Kemp that night, a feeling I had never known before came over me. He held my hands, and it seemed like every hormone in my body reacted. Neither one of us said a word. As the bus was coming to a stop, Kemp leaned over and gently placed his lips on mine. They were like a magnet slowly pulling my lips apart. Once my mouth was open, his tongue explored areas that had never been touched by anything but a toothbrush. I completely forgot where I was until one of the boys sitting near us started banging on the basketball and yelling, "Jesus, y'all! It finally happened! Kemp done did it!" The bus had stopped. The lights were on and everybody was looking at us. Kemp wouldn't stop. He pretended that he didn't even hear the yelling, that we weren't on a bus surrounded by spectators. I tried to pull away, but I was so weak I couldn't control myself. So I just gave in to his kisses. Didn't anyone on the bus say one word or stir, not even Mrs. Evans. No one made a move to get off the bus until Kemp and I did. When Kemp finished kissing me, I saw that he had lipstick all over his mouth. My first reaction was to wipe it off real quick before anyone could see it. Kemp just smiled as I wiped it off. When I finished, he took me by the hand, pulled me up out of the seat, buried my hand in his shoulder, and we walked off the bus. I was very embarrassed about the fact that my first kiss had been such a public thing, but I didn't regret the kiss at all. Once we were back on campus, Kemp and I greeted each other with a kiss every time we met. We never did hide behind trees or posts to sneak kisses like the other students. When Mrs. Evans blinked the lights for the girls to come in, I'd give Kemp a smack on the lips right in front of her. Soon, most of the other girls started smacking kisses on their boyfriends in front of Mrs. Evans, too. Finally, one day, Mrs. Evans called me in for a conference and accused me of leading the kissing game on campus. During the first 6 months of our relationship, I was happier than I had ever been. Kemp turned me on so much that I made the first straight A average that had been made at Natchez in many years. Studying was a cinch, and everything else seemed so easy. But that spring, when the basketball season was all over, and the excitement of traveling was gone, and the boys and girls began swarming all over each other like bees, I slowly began to drift away from the whole scene. I had gotten tired of being part of the club. There was something about the way couples were relaxing into relationships and making them everything that bothered me. I didn't want to get all wrapped up in Kemp the way some of the other girls did with their boyfriends, but my relation with him had gradually become a brother-sister thing. He could tell I was moving away from him, so he got himself a girl in the city. I wasn't even jealous, and I didn't say anything. I just didn't care. I knew I would be leaving him behind next year and figured he'd have somebody else. I pretended that I didn't know he had another girl and went on being friends with him. He was the best friend I had had since Lola, and I told him everything. I had spent all of my money buying foxy clothes when I was high on Kemp. Now, I was down to $90, and I was beginning to worry about where I would go to college next year. It was about 2 months before school ended, and I tried to hold on to that money. I figured I could make at least $200 at the restaurant the coming summer, even if business was bad. But I knew that still wouldn't be enough to get me into a good senior college. The closer it came to school ending, the more depressed I got. One Saturday morning, I got up feeling disgusted. I was sick of having to worry about where my next penny was coming from and how I would get to school next year. I looked at that $90 in my drawer and thought to myself, "This time, I'm gonna go out and have me a big steak and buy me a $50 dress." I went down to breakfast a little late, and when I got there, I saw a whole commotion going on. I stood on the steps looking for a while, wondering what in the hell was happening. A large group of students were standing around a table, talking and gesturing. Others were picking in their plates like they were looking for something. The noise was tremendous. As I headed down the steps, Inez, one of my classmates, who was sitting at the table where all the students were gathered, spotted me and called out, "Hey, Moody, come here. Will you look at this?" Then someone else called, "Go and get yours, Moody, and see if you can find any." I walked over to Inez. She pointed with her fork to the half-eaten plate of grits in front of her. At first, I didn't see anything. "What's going on?" I asked. "Can't you see? Look at there," she said, poking something in the grits with her fork. "What's that?" I asked, seeing a little white lump at the end of her fork. "What's that? A goddamn maggot, that's what it is," one of the boys said loudly. "A maggot in the grits? Where did it come from?" "Don't y'all get mad. That's just a little present from Miss Harris, trying to show us how much she loves us," somebody cracked, and we all laughed. I looked to the kitchen and saw her standing in the door. I remember the morning she used to sling those spoons at me because I wouldn't Uncle Tom to her. I hated her guts. "Uh-oh," somebody said, as Miss Harris started to come over to us. "Here come Mother Maggot now." "What's going on out here?" she asked. When she said that, everyone pointed to Inez's grits. Miss Harris looked. "What's wrong with the grits? They's a little too done," she asked. "Look a little closer, Mama. We're just admiring your latest ingredients," some wise guy said. She leaned over, almost sticking her big nose into the grits. "Watch out! It'll bite you!" someone screamed in mock fright. This really cracked everyone up. When she finally saw the maggot, she turned angrily on the crowd and demanded, "Who's playing jokes out here?" She glared at one of the boys who was still laughing. Everybody suddenly shut up. Miss Harris stood there with her hands on her hips, blowing and a-puffing like she was about to blow us all away. I could feel everyone tense up and grow angry. Suddenly, I noticed one of the girls who helped in the kitchen, motioning frantically and pointing toward the pantry. I walked very deliberately past Miss Harris toward the kitchen. "Where you going, Moody?" Miss Harris yelled as I neared the kitchen. "You stay out of that kitchen. You don't work down here anymore." "Yes, but I am a student here, and I do have to eat this shit," I shouted back. By that time, the others had seen the girl beckoning too, and a lot of them began following me to the kitchen. "What's going on here? What's going on here? Calm down. Stop it," Miss Harris screamed, running after us. "Come out of that kitchen, Moody. Somebody go get President Buck. Moody, I'm going to have you sent away from here yet." I knew exactly where the grits were kept from the time I had worked in the kitchen. I went straight to the pantry and saw that there was a big leak from the showers upstairs. The water was seeping right down onto the shelves. "How long has this been leaking down here?" I called to the girl who had been motioning to us, but now that Miss Harris was standing there, she was too scared to answer. "That's okay. I'll find out," I said. "You want President Buck? I'll get him," I yelled at Miss Harris, who was standing there fuming. I went angrily by her once again, followed by several students. We were about to go over to President Buck's house, which was right next to the dorm, when somebody remembered that he was in Vicksburg for a big meeting. "Okay," I said. "We don't eat until he gets rid of Miss Harris and that leak is fixed." We were just outside the dining room door, and a couple of the guys stormed back inside, hollering, "Boycott! Boycott!" One of them started yelling, "Maggots in the grits! Maggots in the grits! We ain't gonna eat this cooked-up shit!" Then students began to walk out, leaving their plates on the tables right where they were. Usually, we were required to empty our own trays. Then, we all gathered in front of the dorm. Some of the students were arguing. I could tell that a lot of them weren't too hot on boycotting. One of the guys came up to me. "Okay, Moody," he said so everyone could hear. "You running this shit. How we gonna eat? I don't have one penny in my pocket." Several of the others joined in with him. "Yeah, Moody, what's your bright idea now? How we gonna come up with some money?" "Just cause you ain't got no money, you gonna go down there and eat that shit? I would starve first," I shouted. There was a mixed reaction of yells and boos. The same guy who had come up continued the debate. "Okay, so we don't go to the kitchen. You tell us how we're going to eat." "I got some money," I said quickly, thinking of my $90. "Who else got some?" There was dead silence. "I got 20 bucks, Inez yelled out. "Ain't nobody else got some money?" I asked. "Fuck money, man," one of the guys shouted. "Let's telegram Buck and tell him to come back here and take care of this shit." The crowd cheered. "Okay," I said, "but meantime, stay out of that dining room." We tried to telegram Buck, but we couldn't get him. Since it was Saturday and Mrs. Evans was going to march us into town shortly, I took 50 of my $90 and gave 25 of it to the boys. I told them to buy enough food to last a couple of days. Then, a group of girls and I went to town as if we were going to do our regular Saturday shopping. Instead, we borrowed a couple of hot plates from students who lived in the city and bought enough food to last us for a while. On Sunday, the next day, we all sat around on the campus eating fried chicken that we cooked ourselves. It was like a big all-day picnic. Miss Harris had a girl from the kitchen telling the students there was lots of chicken, ice cream, and homemade cake in the dining room. But the students just called her an Uncle Tom and told her to get lost. Monday morning, just as my alarm clock went off at 6:30, Mrs. Evans knocked on my door and said that President Buck was in the lobby to see me. When I got down to the lobby, he was standing with his back to me looking outside. He didn't look like a little fiery dragon this time. "Mrs. Evans said you wanted to see me," I said to his back. He turned quickly as if I had frightened him out of his thoughts. "Look here, Moody. I came in last night at 2 o'clock and found Miss Harris and Mrs. Evans sitting on my doorstep waiting on me. I'm getting pretty tired of you upsetting everybody around here." I stood there listening until he had his say. Evidently, Mrs. Evans and Miss Harris hadn't told him anything about the maggots in the grits or the leaking shower. They just told him that I had started a boycott and hadn't any of the students eaten since Saturday, and barrels of food had gone to waste. When he finished, I told him what had happened. Then I denied that I was responsible for keeping the other students out of the dining room. I told him that I could only account for myself and that I would never go back down there and eat Miss Harris's cooking. When he said that he would get the showers fixed immediately and have Miss Harris throw out the grits, I told him that it wasn't only that, but that Miss Harris herself was nasty. She knew the grits weren't any good, and she cooked them anyway. By Wednesday, the showers were fixed, and the spoiled grits had been thrown out. But Miss Harris was still there, so none of the students went back. I split my last $40 with the boys, and we bought food to last till the weekend, hoping that Miss Harris would be gone by then. But she wasn't. On Sunday, President Buck called a special chapel meeting. He got up and made a lot of excuses for Miss Harris. He said that she had reported the leak over 2 weeks ago to him, but that he was so busy running around trying to get money for the school to buy food for us that he had forgotten about it. The students didn't really believe his sob story, but since all our money and food were gone, the students slowly began to drift back, one by one. I didn't go back at all. But one of my friends told me that now Miss Harris was wearing a snow-white uniform and a hairnet every day. I managed to get by for a while on what friends brought me from the city, but I started losing so much weight and got so hungry all the time that I wrote Mama and told her what had happened. She and Junior came up and brought me a couple of cartons of canned food to last the remainder of the semester. At mid-semester, when our averages were tallied, I had the highest average in the class. Soon after the averages were posted, I was called to President Buck's office. He asked me if I had any plans for going on to college next year. I didn't know what he had up his sleeve, so I came on very cool with him in the beginning. But before our meeting was over, I could tell that he really liked me in spite of all the disturbances I had caused on campus. So I broke down and admitted my worries about going on to college. Then he told me that I could probably get a full scholarship with my high grades. He said that a test would be given in a week or so for scholarships to a couple of the colleges in Mississippi, and that he wanted me to try for them. The following week, the registrar from Tougaloo College, the best senior college in the state for Negroes, came down. I took the test, and a week before school ended, I received notice that I had received a full tuition scholarship. Chapter 20. I could barely wait until September, when I was to enroll in Tougaloo College as a junior. Meanwhile, I tried to find out as much as I could about the school. A girlfriend of mine at Natchez, after learning of my scholarship, told me that Tougaloo was not for people my color. When I asked her what she meant, she merely said, "Baby, you're too black. You gotta be high yellow with a rich-ass daddy." At first, I thought she was jealous because she didn't get a scholarship. But then I thought of the high yellow registrar who had given me the scholarship exam. So I went back to my girlfriend for more information. She tried so hard to convince me not to go. I ended up by accusing her of being jealous, and we had a big fight. A few days later, she came to my room. "Look out that window, Moody. I want to show you something," she said, pointing at a white student out on the lawn talking to some of the guys. "She's a student at Tougaloo, and she ain't white either," she said, and left my room. I didn't believe her. That girl was as white as any woman I had ever seen. I went right downstairs and asked her if she was a student at Tougaloo, when she said, "Yes, I go there," without even looking at me. I just walked away, thinking that Tougaloo wasn't the place for me. After all, that summer, while working at the restaurant, I seriously started looking for a school to attend in New Orleans. Since LSU was only $35 a semester for off-campus students, I thought of going there. But when I learned that it had just been integrated and that all the teachers were white, I talked myself out of going. I was afraid that those white students would murder me in class. I was an A student. But those A's were from Natchez. I didn't have much competition there, I thought. Besides, Natchez wasn't anywhere near as good as LSU. I didn't want the white students to act like they were smarter than me just because they had gotten off to a better start. I kept thinking and talking to myself until September rolled around. By then, it was too late to register in any of the schools in New Orleans, and I knew it. So I sent Tougaloo $10 to reserve a room for me and $5 for my registration fee. One morning in mid-September, my grandmother woke me before she went to work. I got up and made sure all my things were packed. 4 hours later, I was headed for Tougaloo on good old Greyhound. By the time I arrived in Jackson, Mississippi, that evening, I was tired as hell. After wandering around the small segregated station for a while, I asked a little dark-skinned man with glasses how to get to Tougaloo. He smiled and asked, "Are you a freshman?" "No, I'm a junior," I said. We introduced ourselves. He told me his name was Steve and that he was a senior. "I'm waiting for a cab," he said. "We could split the fare if you would like." All during the 7.5 miles to the college, I was dying to ask if he was the only black student there. But instead, we talked about our majors. I didn't like him because he tried too hard to impress me, so I just sat back in the seat without saying much. At last, we came to a sign that said, "Tougaloo Southern Christian College, quarter mile." Soon, we were riding on campus, but by now, it was too dark for me to see what it looked like. The driver dropped Steve off first because he had about 5 suitcases and 2 trunks stacked in front of my luggage. When we stopped in front of the boys' dormitory, some of the boys ran out to help with his suitcases. One of them looked inside the car and said, "I'm Jimmy. What's your name, pretty?" I was so mad because he was yellow that I didn't answer. I wondered how many of the other students were yellow and probably with rich-ass daddies. Anyway, it pleased me to know that mulattoes liked dark brown-skinned girls. Maybe some of the others would, too, I thought. A few minutes later, as I was carrying my own luggage into Galloway Hall, the girls' dormitory, I noticed several girls passing in and out of the lounge and going upstairs. Not all of them were yellow, either. As a matter of fact, some of them were even black. This really pleased me. I was disappointed when I went to the room that had been assigned me and found one of those white-looking girls sitting on a bed, smoking a cigarette.
"Hi, I'm your new roommate," I said.
"I have a roommate," she answered. "You mean you are one of my roommates." I looked at her and wondered if the other one was as white as this one. If so, I couldn't take this diplomatic shit. "Trotter sleeps there," she said, pointing to the lower half of the bunk bed against the opposite wall. "Therefore, you gotta sleep up there."
"Fine with me,"
I said, but I was thinking I would ask to be assigned to another room no later than tomorrow morning. Without saying anything more to her, I began to roll my hair in big rollers. While I was looking in the mirror, I could see her smiling and sizing me up.
"My name is Gloria," she said.
"Mine's Anne," I answered.
"Where are you from? I take it that you're a junior since they put you on this hall."
"Yes, I'm a junior. I'm from Natchez College."
"My home is Natchez," she said. "I live down the street from the college." I was getting tired of her probing, so I simply said,
"Oh."
I took my pajamas from a suitcase and got into bed, the top bunk. "Trotter's not coming until next week. You can sleep in her bed if you like."
"Thanks," I said,
and went to sleep thinking how much I would hate the school. The next morning, I got up around 6 because I wanted to get a glimpse of the campus. After I had taken a shower and dressed, I went outside. I could not believe it. This place was beautiful. It was large and spacious. There was evenly cut grass everywhere and huge old oak trees with lots of hanging moss. Birds were singing, and the air was fresh and clean. I must have walked all over the campus in a trance before I realized I was hungry and went to find some breakfast. I spent the first 2 days going through the regular college routine, registration, meeting faculty. On Thursday, it was announced that there was going to be a freshman and new students talent show to be held on Saturday. All that night, I tried to think of something I could do that would get me off to a good start. I had the feeling that I had to make that first good impression. I thought of singing a song. That was out. I didn't know the type of song that would impress intellectuals. I could sing real well, but nothing but good old Baptist hymns. Since some of my teachers were white, I knew they would not have the right impression after that. Eliminating singing, I thought of dancing. I could not do anything except exotic cafe-style dances. I remembered the exotic dance we'd had in high school, the one that the principal stopped before it got started. I couldn't do that because I didn't want my white friends to think I was vulgar. Finally, I gave up the idea of participating in the talent show and went to sleep. The next morning, walking through the lounge, I noticed some girls doing exercises. That's it, I thought. If I could get them to help me, I could do some tumbling. One of the girls was very agile and graceful. I walked over to her and said, "Hi, my name is Anne. You're very good." "I'm Freddie," she said. "Are you a freshman?"
"No, I'm a junior."
"Lucky you. I'm just beginning." "That's not so bad. It seems like only yesterday that I started. Once you get that start, the time really rolls."
"Yeah, but the thing is getting started," she said.
"I'm on my way to breakfast," I said. "We could talk on our way over, if you like."
She looked at me as if she thought I was funny or something. I guess she thought I had a hang-up on girls. Finally, sounding a little embarrassed, she said yes. By the time we got to that old white frame dining hall, she had said she was willing to do the tumbling in the talent show. We agreed to practice in the lounge that same afternoon. We met around 3. She was good. She was really good. We practiced the fly and the bear until we had them perfect. While we were doing the fly for the last time, we were interrupted by a short, muscular, dark-skinned boy.
My, what acrobats, he said.
"I'm Paul. Do you girls mind letting me in on what's going on?"
Freddie, who was standing on my knees, seemed a little embarrassed again. I was, too. I had to set this cat straight.
"Look," I said, "we're practicing for the talent show tomorrow night."
No, I didn't mean no harm," he said. "You see, my major is P.E. I was just interested. I was trying to think of something to do in the talent show, too. I think maybe the 3 of us could win first prize."
He looked sincere, so I said, "Okay. What can you do?"
"Just about anything."
"Can you tumble?" I asked.
"Yes," he nodded.
"What about the log roll?"
"Sure."
"Okay, that's great," I said. "We have a team. Here's what we're going to do. The bear, the fly, the log roll, and some tumbling."
"I can walk on my hands," he said.
"Let's do that."
"I can't do that," I said, "but it's okay if you do it."
The 3 of us agreed to meet the next day and practice for an hour or so. We needed other people, so I went around looking for other girls to squat for us. I found 3 just before dinner. They thought I was crazy, but I didn't mind. Freddie also had 3 or 4 friends she could depend on. So in about 3 hours, we were to go on stage as unorganized as could be. The show started around 8:30 or a little later. I was kind of nervous about all those scared freshman girls that were supposed to squat for us.
They were so damn scared we would fall on them or something that they might suddenly disappear before we went on. I kept an eye on them to make sure they didn't. There was not too much on the show except singing for quite some time. It was getting boring. Then, just as I began to think of how we were going to show up all those singers, I was shocked. My eyes were glued to the stage as a tall, skinny guy was doing the limbo. He was well over 6'4". Each time he passed under the pole, it was lowered. It kept going down lower and lower, but no part of his body ever touched it, and I mean it was low. Finally, it was lowered about a foot from the floor. Boys in the audience began betting each other that he couldn't do it. Everyone was all worked up. I knew he was going to win. He went under that pole 12 inches from the floor, feet still flat, and didn't touch that damn pole anywhere. Next, a guy came on playing a set of bongo drums. The audience seemed impressed. They were rocking heads and clapping hands rhythmically with the drums. I didn't think he was so good. I just thought they were still excited from the performance of that limbo cat, because I was. Now it was our turn. I beckoned to my crowd, and we walked backstage looking like a bunch of beatniks or something. Boys began bellowing to Ramona, the MC. "What's going on, Ramona? What are they gonna do?" Ramona shrugged her shoulders, indicating she didn't know. When she introduced us, she said, "Next on the program, we have Ann Moody and the Tumblers." I put my best smile on and walked to the center of the stage. The reaction from the crowd was wild, especially the boys. They started shouting, whistling, and carrying on something terrible. I wore some skin-tight red short shorts over black leotards and looked even taller than 5'9". I guess it was the contrast of the colors that started the boys. Maybe they thought they were going to see some sort of burlesque. I stopped blushing and smiling long enough to say, "We'll do the bear, followed by the fly, the log roll, and a little bit of tumbling." Someone in the audience said, "Sure enough." I beckoned for Freddie. She walked to the center of the stage, and we stood facing each other. I again turned to the audience and said, "If this act reminds you of a bear, let us know by your generous applause." As I stood facing Freddie again, I opened my legs by placing my feet about 2 feet apart. Then I braced myself. Freddie placed a hand on each of my shoulders. She then jumped around my waist, locking her legs behind my back with her hands clasped to my ankles. I leaned forward until the palms of my hands were flat on the floor. I began to walk on my hands and feet. The audience applauded long after we had stopped. The fly and the log roll also received lots of applause. Then Paul and I tumbled. We started by diving over one person squatted on hands and knees on the floor. Each dive was completed with a forward roll. Another person squatted next to the first one. We then dove over 2, then 3 lined up side by side. After that, one person was placed on top of the one squatting on the center. We completed that dive successfully. This left the audience tense and worried that something would happen. By the time Paul and I had dived over 9 bodies stacked like a pyramid, the entire audience was standing. The applause went on and on. We all came to the center of the stage and bowed. As we were about to walk off the stage, Paul started walking all around on his hands. The audience laughed, whistled, and applauded even louder, and some shouted, "More! More! More!" I knew we were too much for them. After a couple of songs, the show ended. We received first prize, the limbo cat second, and one of the girls that sang got the third prize. After the show was over and our prize had been awarded, the dean of the college stopped me to say that we were good and that if we would like to do something with our talent, the school was ready to help us. He asked me if I was a physical education major. I said no, that my intention was to major in biology. A few days later, he sent the physical education instructor to talk to me, and I told her the same thing. Soon after classes began, I discovered I had only one Negro teacher for the semester. I began to get scared all over again. I had never had a white teacher before. Now I wished I had gone to LSU. I knew the whites in New Orleans weren't half as bad as the ones in Mississippi. I kept remembering the ones in my hometown, those that had Samuel O'Quinn murdered, those that burned the entire Taplin family, and those I worked for who treated me like a secondhand dirty dish towel. I got so damn mad just sitting there thinking about those white teachers. Chills started running down my back. I knew that if they were at all like the whites I had previously known, I would leave the school immediately. By this time, I had become friendly with my second roommate, Trotter, who was even darker than me. I asked her whether or not she thought I could take it at Tougaloo. If I couldn't, I didn't want to waste my little bit of money. Trotter laughed and said, "Girl, I had the same feeling when I was a freshman. I came here, scared stiff. I didn't know what to expect. I had heard about the white teachers, the high yellow students and all." "I'm an A student, Trotter, but I've never had any of those tough white teachers. I know I'm going to have some problems." "No, no, Moody. I came from a little country high school, too. Here, I am an honor student. You can do the same. All teachers start off pretending they are hot shit. It's the same with Negro teachers. You know that." "If their disposition is anything similar to the whites in my hometown, I couldn't take that shit either," I said. "But these teachers here on campus are all from up north or Europe or someplace. We don't have one white teacher here from the south. Northern whites have a different attitude toward Negroes." "I certainly hope so," I said, relieved of some of my fright. By the time mid-semester exams rolled in, I had gotten off to a very good start. It looked as though I could make the honor roll if I continued at this pace. I began to relax. I started taking time with my clothes, watching my weight, and wanting to look good. Kemp had not written in about a month. I started to worry because I knew that most of my girlfriends at Natchez College wanted him. I thought I'd better find me someone at Tougaloo to pass the time with. I knew I'd have to do some looking since there were three girls on campus to every boy. Three or four guys showed lots of interest in me, but they were already dating girls I knew. Finally, in December, I started dating one of them, a guy named Dave Jones. As it turned out, when the semester ended, I didn't make that damn honor roll. I came out with 3 points less than I needed. I rationalized by blaming my downfall on my adjustment to the white teachers. However, the real cause was that damn Dave. All he could think of after we had gone together for a month was going to bed. I didn't even like him that much, not enough to go to bed with him anyway. When we had a so-called adult discussion about sex, as he called it, I told him that I was a virgin, and I was afraid to be screwing around on campus. He kept telling me that he would take care of me, that he wouldn't hurt me, and all that shit. To get him off my back, I told him that I would only when I felt I was ready. After another month or so, when I still wasn't ready, he got mad, and one night in the park, he tried to take me. We were walking back from the Greasy Spoon, a little student hangout right outside the campus gate. He had drunk quite a bit of beer, and now he suggested that we sit on a bench and talk for a while. I agreed, only to discover that he wanted to start petting and going on. "Dave, let's go, okay?" I said. "Why are you in such a hurry? It's Saturday night. You could sleep late tomorrow." "I just want to go," I said, trembling. "Okay," he said. "Give me one sweet kiss, and we can leave." When I kissed him, I could taste the beer and cigarettes he'd had at the Greasy Spoon.
I didn't like this at all, so I drew away. He got mad and jerked me to him, kissing me hard. He started caressing my breasts and breathing on my neck and everything.
"Let go of me, Dave!"
I started crying. Then we saw another couple coming through the gate. Dave didn't want to act as if something was going on, so he let me go, but held on to my sweater. I jumped up to leave and tore every button off it. I ran back to the dormitory, vowing I would never see Dave again. On Monday, I got a letter from him begging me to forgive him. He promised to buy me a new sweater and everything. I didn't want to go through that shit again, so I just acted as if I hadn't got the letter. He had asked me to call him, but I wouldn't. I was through, and that was that. One night, shortly after Dave and I had broken up, I asked Trotter what kind of meetings she was always going to. She said,
"I thought you knew.
I'm secretary of the NAACP chapter here on campus."
"I didn't even know they had a chapter here,"
I said.
"Why don't you become a member? We're starting a voter registration drive in Hinds County, and we need canvassers. Besides, it would give you something to do in your spare time now that you don't see Dave anymore."
I promised her that I would go to the next meeting. All that night, I didn't sleep. Everything started coming back to me. I thought of Samuel O'Quinn. I thought of how he had been shot in the back with a shotgun because they suspected him of being a member. I thought of Reverend Dupree and his family who had been run out of Woodville when I was a senior in high school, and all he had done was to get up and mention NAACP in a sermon. The more I remembered the killings, beatings, and intimidations, the more I worried what might possibly happen to me or my family if I joined the NAACP. But I knew I was going to join anyway. I had wanted to, for a long time. Chapter 21. A few weeks after I got involved with the Tougaloo chapter of the NAACP, they organized a demonstration at the state fair in Jackson. Just before it was to come off, Medgar Evers came to campus and gave a big, hearty speech about how Jackson was gonna move. Tougaloo sent four picketers to the fair, and one of them was Dave Jones. Because he was chosen to be the spokesman for the group, he was the first to be interviewed on TV. That evening, when the demonstration was televised on all the news programs, it seemed as though every girl in the dorm was down in the lounge in front of the set. They were all shooting off about how they would take part in the next demonstration. The girl Dave was now seeing was running all around talking about how good he looked. Dave and the other demonstrators had been arrested and were to be bailed out around 8 that night. By 8:30, a lot of us were sitting outside on the dormitory steps awaiting their arrival, and they still hadn't shown up. One of the girls had just gone inside to call the NAACP headquarters in Jackson, when suddenly two police cars came speeding through the campus. Students came running from every building. Within minutes, the police cars were completely surrounded, blocked in from every direction. There were two cops in the front seat of each car. They looked frightened to death of us. When the students got out of the cars, they were hugged, kissed, and congratulated for well over an hour. All during this time, the cops remained in their seats behind locked doors. Finally, someone started singing, "We Shall Overcome," and everyone joined in. When we finished singing, someone suggested we go to the football field and have a big rally. In minutes, every student was on the football field, singing all kinds of freedom songs, giving testimonies as to what we were going to do, and praying and carrying on something terrible. The rally ended at 12:30, and by this time, all the students were ready to tear Jackson to pieces. The following evening, Medgar Evers again came to campus to, as he put it, get some of Tougaloo's spirit and try and spread it around all over Jackson. He gave us a good pep talk and said we would be called upon from time to time to demonstrate. That spring term, I had really wanted to do well in all my subjects,
but I had become so wrapped up in the movement that by the time mid-semester grades came out, I had barely a one-point average. Other students who had gotten involved with the NAACP were actually flunking. I started concentrating more on my work, with little success. It seemed as though everything was going wrong. In addition to my academic problems, I was running out of money. In May, I was so broke I could not pay my last month's bill and was forced to write Mama and ask her to send me $30. A couple of weeks went by without a letter from her. If Mama had the money, I knew she would have sent it. Apparently, she didn't have it, but why didn't she write anyway? Finally, I got a letter from Adeline, who was working in New Orleans. Mama had written Adeline and asked her to send me some money because Raymond wouldn't let her send me any herself. Adeline could only spare $10, and she wrote me that she was sorry I had gone to Tougaloo when I knew I could not afford it. The letter made me so mad that I was sick all the next week. I decided to write Emma and ask her for the $30. She sent me $40 right away and said that she and my daddy would have helped me more and that they wanted to, but my daddy had been bothered with his back and had not been working. Emma's money took care of the spring term, but now I was faced with the problem of the summer. I had to make up some credits in summer school, and I was counting on getting a student loan. One day, as I passed the main bulletin board on campus, I noticed a memorandum from the dean saying that applications for federal loans had to be turned in before the week was up. The next day, I stopped in at the dean's office to pick up a form. His secretary told me that I was too late. There were too many applicants already. I went to see the dean and had to give him my whole damn life story. I didn't like that at all, but I needed the money. I told him I wouldn't be able to graduate next year if I couldn't go to summer school. He wasn't very encouraging, but he gave me a form to fill out just in case one of the other students had a change in plans. My luck was so bad, I didn't believe this could possibly happen. By now, I was so low, I needed someone's comfort. I started seeing Dave again, and the same old trouble started. But this time, I didn't care so much. School would be out soon, and I wouldn't see him again. Dave would graduate if anyone did. He had even received a Woodrow Wilson Fellowship. I took my final exams and was preparing to leave the campus when I received a notice from the dean's office. It said that I had been given the sum of $150 to assist me in summer school. Even though I had asked for $300, I started feeling better. Better than I had felt in a long time. I didn't know how I would manage on $150, but I knew I would find some way to do it. During the summer, a white student moved into the room across the hall from me. Her name was Joan Trumpower, and she told me she worked for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, as a secretary. In a short time, we got to know each other very well, and soon I was going into Jackson with Joan and hanging out at her office. SNCC was starting a voter registration drive in the Delta, Greenwood and Greenville, and was recruiting students at Tougaloo. When they asked me if I wanted to canvass every other weekend, I agreed to go. The first time I went to the Delta, I was with three other girls. A local family put us up, and we slept two to a room. The second time I was there, I stayed at the Freedom House, a huge white frame house that SNCC was renting from a widow for $60 a month. This time I was with Betty Poole, who had been canvassing for SNCC for a couple of months, and Carolyn Quinn, a new recruit like me. We arrived at the Freedom House on a Friday night about 12:30 and found 15 boys all sleeping in one large room on triple-decker beds. They were all sleeping in their clothes. Some of the boys got up and we played cards for a while. A couple of them were from Macomb, Mississippi, which was only 20 miles from Centerville. We cracked jokes about how bad the whites were in Wilkinson County. Around 2 a.m., I started to get sleepy and asked where the girls were going to stay. I was told we were going to stay right in the same room with all the boys. I was some shocked. Now I understood why Betty Poole was wearing jeans. Just then, she was climbing into one of the empty bunks and settling down for the night. Here I was with only a transparent nylon pajama set to sleep in. Carolyn Quinn wasn't prepared either. The two of us just sat up in chairs until some extra pairs of pants were found for us. The boys explained that they slept in their clothes because they had had bomb threats and had to be ready to run any time. They all slept here in this one big room because it was sheltered by another house. The next morning, I woke up to the sounds of someone banging on a skillet and hollering, "Come and get it! Come and get it!" When we walked in the kitchen, the boy who'd made the racket said, "All right, girls, take over. Us boys have been cooking all week." Most of the guys were angry because we had gotten them up in that manner, but they didn't make a big fuss over it. Carolyn and I started cooking. When we announced that the food was ready, the boys ran over each other to get to the kitchen. It seemed they thought the food would disappear. It did. Within 5 minutes, everything on the table was gone. The food ran out and three boys were left standing in line. I really got to like all of the SNCC workers. I had never known people so willing and determined to help others. I thought Bob Moses, the director of SNCC in Mississippi, was Jesus Christ in the flesh. A lot of other people thought of him as J.C. too. The SNCC workers who were employed full-time were paid only $10 a week. They could do more with that $10 than most people I knew could do with $50. Sometimes when we were in the Delta, the boys would take us out. We did not finish with our work some Saturdays until 10 or 11, and all the Negro places had a 12 o'clock curfew. But we would have more fun in an hour than most people could have in 24. We would often go to one place where the boys had made friends with the waitresses, and they would sneak us fifths of liquor. Those SNCC boys had friends everywhere. Among the Negroes, that is. Most whites were just waiting for the chance to kill them all off. I guess mostly the SNCC workers were just lucky. Most of them had missed a bullet by an inch or so on many occasions. Threats didn't stop them. They just kept going all the time. One Saturday we got to Greenville and discovered that the office had been bombed Friday night. The office was located up two flights of outside steps in a little broken-down building. It seemed as though a real hard wind would have blown it away. The bomb knocked the steps off, but that didn't stop the rally on Saturday night. Some of the boys made steps. When the new steps began to collapse, we ended up using a ladder. I remember when the rally ended, we found that the ladder was gone. For a few minutes, we were real scared. We just knew some whites had moved it. We were all standing up there in the doorway wondering what to do. There was only one exit, and it was too high up to jump from. We figured we were going to be blown up. It seemed as though the whites had finally trapped us. The high school students were about to panic when suddenly one of the SNCC boys came walking up with a ladder and yelled up to ask if the excitement was over. A lot of the other guys were mad enough to hit him. Those that did only tapped him lightly and smiled as they did it. The nerve of those guys, I thought. Things didn't seem to be coming along too well in the Delta. On Saturdays, we would spend all day canvassing, and often at night, we would have mass rallies. But these were usually poorly attended. Many Negroes were afraid to come. In the beginning, some were even afraid to talk to us. Most of these old plantation Negroes had been brainwashed so by the whites, they really thought that only whites were supposed to vote. There were even a few who had never heard of voting. The only thing most of them knew was how to handle a hoe. For years, they had demonstrated how well they could do that. Some of them had calluses on their hands so thick
They would hide them if they noticed you looking at them. On Sundays, we usually went to Negro churches to speak. We were split into groups according to our religious affiliation. We were supposed to know how to reach those with the same faith as ours. In church, we hoped to be able to reach many more Negroes. We knew that even those that slammed doors in our faces or said, "I don't want no part of voting," would be there. There would also be the school teachers and the middle-class professional Negroes who dared not participate. They knew that once they did, they would lose that $250 a month job. But the people started getting wise to us. Most of them stopped coming to church. They knew if they came, they would have to face us. Then the ministers started asking us not to come because we scared their congregations away. SNCC had to come up with a new strategy. As the work continued that summer, people began to come around. I guess they saw that our intentions were good, but some began getting fired from their jobs, thrown off plantations, and left homeless. They could often find somewhere else to stay, but food and clothing became a problem. SNCC started to send representatives to Northern College campuses. They went begging for food, clothing, and money for the people in Mississippi, and the food, clothing, and money started coming in. The Delta Negroes still didn't understand the voting, but they knew they had found friends. Friends they could trust. That summer, I could feel myself beginning to change.